It was Tuesday in the business week of the Congress of the United States. And at noon, Congress was scheduled to perform one of its most important acts in its almost 9-year history. It would be receiving the resignation of George Washington. The great Revolutionary War was over. The peace treaty had been signed, and Washington had finally had the ultimate satisfaction he would experience as General-in-Chief of the Continental Army by supervising the evacuation of the British occupying forces from New York City. It was a spectacle worthy of the annals. "We had been accustomed for a long time," wrote one New Yorker, "to military display and all the finish and finery of garrison life. The troops just leaving us were as if equipped for show, and with their scarlet uniforms and burnished arms, made a brilliant display. The troops that marched in, on the contrary, were ill-clad and weather-beaten and made a forlorn appearance. But then they were our troops. And as I looked at them and thought upon all they had done and suffered for us, my heart and eyes were full, and I admired and gloried in them the more, because they were weather-beaten and forlorn." Once the last British soldier had boarded the last transport and disappeared over the horizon, a week of celebrations followed, with Washington at the center. He had one more responsibility to his officers, though, and that was a farewell event at Francis Tavern on Pearl Street, which proved to be almost as emotionally taxing as the long years of campaigning. They ate, they toasted, and at the end, Washington was almost too emotional to speak. With a heart full of love and gratitude, he rose to say, "I now take leave of you. I most devoutly wish that your latter days may be as prosperous and happy as your former ones have been glorious and honorable." And then he added, "I cannot come to each of you to take my leave, but shall be obliged if each of you will come and take me by the hand." The first to do so was faithful old Henry Knox. And as he did, Washington impulsively seized him in an unaccustomed embrace. And with a final salute, he was gone. 4 days later, Washington arrived in Philadelphia to a tumultuous welcome, went through another round of welcomes in Wilmington, Delaware, and in Baltimore, and finally arrived at the doorstep of Congress. Which was odd, of course, because Congress was meeting in the Maryland State House in Annapolis, rather than in Philadelphia, which had served as the de facto capital of the United States for much of the Revolution. What was more odd was that Congress was not actually quite ready to meet Washington. It had not been able to assemble a quorum of representatives from the 13 newly independent states until December 13th. And by the time Washington arrived in Annapolis, only 7 of the states had actually sent representatives. Nevertheless, precisely at noon, and Washington was a stickler for time, Washington appeared at the doors of the State House, and the President of the Congress announced, "Sir, the United States in Congress assembled are prepared to receive your communications." Washington had never been much of an orator, and in what he knew would be his final communication to Congress as their general, his hand shook. "Happy in the confirmation of our independence and sovereignty, and pleased with the opportunity afforded the United States of becoming a respectable nation, I have now the honor of presenting myself to surrender the trust committed to me and to claim the indulgence of retiring from the service of my country." And taking from his coat pocket the folded commissioning document, he put that and the text of his resignation announcement into the hands of Congress's President, Thomas Mifflin. And that was surely the oddest moment of them all. We do not have long memories for the first 9 presidents. That's because the first 9 presidents are not the men we think are the first 9 presidents. We think George Washington was the first president, John Adams the second, and so on. And so they were, under the Constitution of 1787. But from 1781, before the Revolutionary War was actually over, And the day Washington took the oath under the new Constitution, America had a different Constitution and a succession of different presidents. They were not, strictly speaking, presidents of the United States. They were the presidents of Congress, elected by the membership of the Congress, created by America's first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation. Nor, except for one, were these presidents necessarily very memorable. Each served only a year's term, and they included Thomas McCain of Delaware, John Hanson of Maryland, Elias Boudinot of New Jersey, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, John Hancock, the only name we're easily liable to recognize, Nathan Gorham from Massachusetts, Arthur Sinclair, who was actually a Scot but who hailed from western Pennsylvania, and Cyrus Griffin, a lawyer from Virginia whose most daring feat had been to elope with the daughter of an earl. Third in this list was the man into whose hands Washington surrendered his commission, Thomas Mifflin. And that fact underscores a very great deal of what was wrong with Congress, with the Articles of Confederation, and with the United States in 1783. Thomas Mifflin was closing in on his 40th birthday on the day Washington appeared before him in the Annapolis State House. And it cannot have been a birthday Mifflin planned to celebrate with much mirth. He was born into a well-off family of Pennsylvania Quakers who were torn between the Quaker demand for simplicity and self-denial of the world's baubles, and a desire for Thomas to enjoy the fairly substantial collection of worldly baubles his industrious father had won for the family. Young Mifflin was therefore given the dignity of a collegiate education at the College of Philadelphia, but less for the education and more for the dignity. And as soon as he graduated at the tender age of 16, he was suitably positioned with a Philadelphia merchant, married his well-connected cousin Sarah Morris, and went into business for himself with his brother George in 1765 in a store at Front and Chestnut Streets in Philadelphia. Money flowed into his grasp with unquakerly effortlessness. And by 1770, various high-profile public service appointments were also falling into his lap. He was a city warden, a manager of the Pennsylvania Hospital, a director of the library company, a trustee of his alma mater. Finally, in 1773, he achieved the pinnacle of social respectability. The great Boston-based portrait painter, John Singleton Copley, produced an amiable joint portrait of the Mifflins. The coming of the American Revolution did nothing to disturb the arc of Mifflin's rise. He was one of the supporters of the embargo on British imports that protested the Stamp Act, was elected to the Pennsylvania Assembly in 1772, and was named to represent Pennsylvania in the First Continental Congress in 1774. He almost naturally assumed that leadership positions should fall to him, and people almost naturally assumed that it would be a good idea for a man as financially well off as Mifflin to get them. When the news of Lexington and Concord arrived, Mifflin organized a military company out of his own pocket, which got him read out of meeting by his fellow Quakers, not that he ever showed he minded much. And with the organization of the Continental Army, Washington tapped Mifflin as a staff member. Although Mifflin quickly climbed the ladder of rank, with promotions to Brigadier General and Major General following in due course, something about this man with the silver Quaker spoon in his mouth seems to have acquired tarnish for Washington and to a few others. John Adams thought Mifflin a man of great spirit, activity, and abilities, a gentleman of education, family, and fortune. But Abigail Adams was more skeptical. You hear nothing from the ladies but about Major Mifflin's easy address, politeness, complaisance, etc., etc. 'Tis well he has so agreeable a lady at Philadelphia. In 1775, Washington shunted him from frontline service to quartermaster general of the Army. This affronted Mifflin, who conceived of himself as a military as well as a mercantile genius. And although Mifflin sullenly agreed to serve, he never ceased to agitate for restoration to field command. When frontline command failed to materialize on a permanent basis, Mifflin then turned his disappointment on Washington. Bitterly critical of Washington's failed attempt to defend Philadelphia in 1777, Mifflin resigned his commission in a huff and joined the agitators known as the Conway Cabal, who were seeking to depose Washington as general-in-chief. The conspiracy failed. However, as one of his subordinates grumbled, Mifflin's manners were better adapted to attract popularity than preserve it. And so he was soon back in the political saddle as a member of the Continental Congress. And in November of 1783, he was elected the third president of Congress under the Articles of Confederation. And there began Thomas Mifflin's career of woe. The American colonies had always had closer ties, individually, to Great Britain than they had had to each other. And even getting them to send representatives, first to the Stamp Act Congress in 1765, and then to the Continental Congress in 1774 and 1775, had been no small achievement. As it was, the Continental Congress was merely a deliberative body. It had no official powers, no revenue to pay the bills of the revolutionary conflict, and no means of enforcing its decisions apart from the army, which it paid and equipped in such a penny-pinching manner that the army was twice on the edge of mutiny, first in 1781 and again in 1783. The states themselves sometimes seemed more intent on pursuing their own agendas than in a joint effort to fight off the British. Virginia sent militia beyond the Appalachians to stake claims to territory in the West. Connecticut and Pennsylvania fought over who had proper title to the Wyoming Valley in northeastern Pennsylvania. State militia officers tried to conscript members of the Continental Army and fined them for noncompliance. Vermont staked out its own claims to independence, not just from the British, but from New York and New Hampshire, both of whom insisted that they were the lawful rulers of the Green Mountains. It was only when America's French allies folded their arms and made it clear that they would do nothing more for the Americans until they stopped quarreling like 13 little German duchies and submitted to a common government that the French could recognize and support, that the ill-humored delegations in Congress sank their disagreements and adopted a 3,300-word Articles of Confederation. Even then, the Articles were only a firm league of friendship with each other, in which each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right. And it took 4 years, from 1777 till 1781, before the states finally ratified the Articles. Not that this changed much. The ratification of the Articles of Confederation on March 1, 1781, was greeted in Philadelphia with the discharge of the artillery on the land and the cannon of the shipping in the Delaware. The bells were rung, and every manifestation of joy shone on the occasion. Otherwise, the Continental Congress simply continued to conduct business, now as the Confederation Congress, and the Continental Congress's presiding officer, Samuel Huntington, continued in that role until Thomas McCain was duly elected as the first president chosen under the Articles. But the surrender of British forces at Yorktown in the fall of 1781 gave less cause for rejoicing than might be thought. The Articles had provided no new means of raising revenue, and the wartime debts Congress had incurred to the French government, to Dutch bankers, and even to Americans who were owed money for supplies and the Continental Army, which had been only fitfully paid. Congress had no way to deal with this. At the end of the war, the debts contracted by the United States had amounted to the towering figure of $10 million in loans. $4.4 million came from the French, another $1.8 million from the Dutch. But this was only the foreign debt. Congress had also issued reams of paper money and IOUs in the form of quartermaster and commissary certificates that amounted to around $400 million, and which constituted yet another form of indebtedness. And none of this included the debts that individual state governments had contracted during the Revolution. By the time the charming Thomas Mifflin had assumed the role of president, the Confederation Congress had tried, without much to show for its efforts, to remedy its financial woes by proposing the adoption of a federal import tariff known as an impost. A month before the articles were formally ratified, Congress proposed an amendment which placed a 5% tariff upon all goods, wares, and merchandise of foreign growth and manufacture, which should be imported into any of the said states from any foreign port, island, or plantation, the proceeds arising from the said duties to be appropriated to the discharge of the debts contracted or to be contracted on the faith of the United States for supporting the present war. This was not a particularly onerous measure. The total proceeds would have little more oomph to them than keeping up the interest payments. But that was too much for the Solons of Rhode Island, which, despite being the smallest of the 13 states, had to agree to the impost because the articles, in Article 10, demanded unanimous approval for any amendment. And Rhode Island was not going to approve. The state legislature hemmed and hawed, hoping some other state would announce noncompliance first. But at length, in October 1782, they voted unanimously to disapprove the impost as a violation of Rhode Island's sovereignty. Congress tried again in March 1783 with another impost proposal, this time limited to just 25 years. It failed too. Nor was this the only problem confronting President Mifflin when he assumed office on November 3, 1783. The Continental Army, underpaid and undervalued, had nearly taken Congress by the neck in 1781 when the Pennsylvania regiments, starving and shivering in camp at Morristown, New Jersey, sent an angry delegation of sergeants to Philadelphia to meet an unnerved committee of Congress about their grievances. A far more ominous outburst occurred at the beginning of 1783, when a delegation comprising General Alexander McDougall and two colonels showed up in Philadelphia to meet with Congress. Not only had they gone unpaid, but with the nearness of peace, they suspected that Congress would attempt to disband the army and send it home with nothing more than promises. "We have borne all that men can bear. Our property is expended. Our private resources are at an end, and our friends are wearied out and disgusted, and any further experiments on their patience may have fatal effects." Washington himself would give no countenance to what was an attempt to frighten Congress into action. And he staged a showdown at Newburgh, New York, in March with his officers to make it plain that he wanted neither part nor lot with any plans to use force on Congress. But in June, 80 men of the 3rd Pennsylvania Regiment took matters in their own hands, marched on Philadelphia, surrounded the State House, now Independence Hall, where Congress was sitting, and menacingly warned Congress to act, or otherwise we shall instantly let in those injured soldiers upon you and abide by the consequences. Congress promptly adjourned, without going President Boudinot wisely announcing that the next session would convene on June 26th in Princeton, New Jersey. did after a fashion. It took another month for a quorum of Congress's 23 members to show up. Nor was it possible to keep a quorum once obtained. And so Congress resolved to move again to Annapolis. It was an omen that Congress had elected Mifflin as president the day before adjourning in Princeton, while Mifflin was not in attendance. On November 22nd, the newly arrived Treaty of Peace between Great Britain and the United States was delivered to Mifflin in Philadelphia. And if ever a topic should have brought a quorum roaring to a congressional session, it should have been for the vote ratifying the treaty, especially since the British had set a deadline of March for acceptance and return of the treaty. But neither the treaty nor Thomas Mifflin could make a quorum happen. Every state had to send at least two delegates under the Articles, according to Article 5, and seven such state delegations had shown up by December 13th. But 3 days later, Thomas Jefferson, serving as a delegate from Virginia, complained, "We have no certain prospect of nine states in Congress and cannot ratify the treaty with fewer. Yet the ratifications are to be exchanged by the 3rd of March." On the day of Washington's arrival at the statehouse doors, Mifflin had to prod by letter delegations from New Hampshire, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, South Carolina, and Georgia to show up because the safety, honor, and good faith of the United States require the immediate attendance of their delegates in Congress. In fact, Congress would not have enough representatives on hand in Annapolis to take a vote on the peace treaty until January 14th. And only because the British wanted peace as badly as the Americans was the deadline finally extended by the British until May 12th, when the ratifications were formally exchanged. Thereafter, even the feeble urgency summoned up by the peace treaty disappeared. Over the next 4 miserable months in Annapolis, Congress was able to achieve a quorum on 3 days. The others were passed in adopting teasing resolutions. When it finally adjourned on June 3rd, it resolved to get out of Annapolis and reconvene in Trenton, where they would elect a new president to relieve the unhappy Thomas Mifflin, and proceed to wait for nearly a full month more before enough delegations showed up to elect Richard Henry Lee as Mifflin's successor. In January 1785, Congress would move again, this time to New York City, where it would end its days 4 years later. It has to be said, in at least partial defense of the Confederation Congress, that the Congress was not a total failure. It managed to head off further conflict between states with claims on Western land by writing a Northwest Ordinance, which would organize the West as entirely new states, rather than extended colonies of the original 13. It wrote trade agreements with Britain, France, and Spain, and it struggled to recall a substantial portion of the valueless paper money and certificates it had put into circulation during the Revolution, shrinking that circulation down to about $34 million. It also successfully demobilized the Continental Army through furloughs, more IOUs, and emergency borrowing, before the Army could turn, like Oliver Cromwell's New Model Army, on its creator. But none of those accomplishments could dispel the larger cloud of failure which hung over the Confederation, and perhaps over the American cause itself. It has already been spread throughout Europe by the emissaries of the British court, wrote North Carolina Representative Richard Speight on October 16, 1784, that the United States are only united in name, and that a little time will show that we are incapable of governing ourselves, that great dissensions prevail in the different states, and that we are unwilling, if not unable, to pay the debts we have contracted during the war. Thomas Mifflin retired from his congressional presidency and spent most of the remaining 16 years of his life in Pennsylvania politics, and in what one acidulous critic described as a state of adultery with many women, wholly dissipated and given to low company. He managed to get 2 towns, 5 townships, a county, and a fort named for himself, but he also burned through most of his family's fortune and ended up hiding from bill collectors. One wonders, in that light, if Thomas Mifflin, who had wilted once before under Washington's gaze, might not have seen a glint in Washington's eye as the general-in-chief handed over his commission, a glint that said, "My troubles are now over, and yours have just begun."